You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston, tōki ingoa, nō mai haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to the Monday Wire Wharahina Monday. Where are we now? The 12th of August.
Wow,
it's my mum's birthday, so happy birthday to my mum.
Jemima's mum.
Yeah, I'm Jemima, your host, and I'm joined in studio by Lachlan, who's back after a couple of weeks, but how are you?
I'm good, it's good to be back. The weather is typically Auckland. I did not bring an umbrella, I did not check the weather. Because what's the point these days?
I feel like there's a lot of people this morning as well, because it sort of looked like it was going to be okay, and then just rain.
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know, every winter I say, this is the winter I get like a blunt or, you know, a good umbrella, but I never do.
Do you get umbrella envy as well when you
see
people with blunt umbrellas?
Really, or just with like
a nice cool
umbrella. I like those ones that are plastic and kind of very
domed,
like a little dome. Anyway.
Yeah, anyway. So, sidetracked. On the show today, Lachlan speaks to Cosmo Jeffrey from the Howard League about the Waitangi Tribunal's scathing report on the prisoner voting ban. Southern Cross is back with the latest in Pacific news. I speak to Green Party co-leader James Shaw about the changes to the Misuse of Drugs Act, the abortion legislation bill passing its first reading, and waste minimisation. And Lachlan wraps it up with a talk to Richard Medlicott about why prescription drug advertising should be banned. He aho o whakaaro, if you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we would love to hear from you. Tuku pātui mai, send through a text to 5395, or wire mai, you can call the studio to chat with us on 309 3879. Let's get into it. I don't have a sting, so we're just
I'll just drop that down.
Yeah, go.
So yeah, the Waitangi Tribunal today released its report on the ban on prisoner voting, saying it disproportionately affected Māori and the government should act urgently to repeal it before the next election. This follows a recent Supreme Court decision saying the ban was inconsistent with the Bill of Rights Act. I spoke with Cosmo Jeffrey from the Howard League New Zealand about the ban and why it needs to be overturned, and here is Cosmo.
As you probably know, I'm the president of Howard League Canterbury.
Yes.
And I was actually in jail in Invercargill in the 2002 election.
Oh.
It might have been 2001 going 2002. And they had, in those days, they had a ban on if your sentence was more than 2 years, you couldn't vote. But I was down there and they made a mistake, and in Invercargill, anyone who was in jail could vote. And it was quite interesting because, for one thing, we got unlocked, which is really a bonus. When you're getting locked up all the time, to be unlocked was a bonus. But it was really interesting how the guys just stood around the wing and talked about... So in the middle of the wing, inside the prison, they set up this cardboard voting booth. So it was quite funny, really. And then you were allowed to go in and vote. And then what happened then after you vote, you were allowed to stand around talking. And it was amazing the political discussions that took place. And I'd been in that jail for about 5 months, and I hadn't talked politics to anybody, ever. And just to have that freedom to be able to talk about, oh, yeah, what does this mean? And do you think it makes any difference? And, you know, what's the point of voting anyway? And it was a whole discussion that basically took place only because of that. So to me, it just showed that even if you're locked up inside without your freedom, you can still have that access and connected to society. And I think that's a, you know, valid right that we need to uphold.
I suppose it's quite amazing, being separated but still being aware of what's going on around you and being engaged with it is quite interesting, really.
Yeah, it was also, I noticed in the weeks leading up to the election, I think because people had voted and the results that came after that, people were fighting over the press and the newspaper to see if the people they had actually voted for had got in. And it was that whole connection that just wouldn't have happened. And I think that it was just a small kind of scenario of what can happen if you've got some connection to the outside world.
So the Waitangi Tribunal this morning released a report that said that this ban on voting disproportionately affects Māori and should be overturned. Why does it disproportionately affect Māori?
Well, obviously, there are about 52% of the population of our prisons are Māori, and they're about 15% of the population, so they're hugely misrepresented in jail as it is.
Mm.
And then what you have to realise is, once you lose your right to vote, when you get out, it just doesn't magically appear. You've got to physically go and re-register. And with lots of people having cell phones and no landlines, with a lot of people who come out of prison don't know exactly where they're going to be, they have issues with accommodation anyway. So trying then to put on top of all of that, the necessity to go in and basically enrol to vote for the next election, is something that's just not happening. And there's, I think there's huge statistics to show that once people lose the right to vote when they're in jail, a huge proportion of people don't even bother getting it back. So that means they're disenfranchised not only for when they're in jail, but when they come out, the disenfranchisement lasts for as long as they get settled and think, oh, well, maybe I should vote. So it is a big hindrance for democracy, for people who get out of jail and then don't get round to voting.
And in the past, the government has said it's not really a priority bringing back the right to vote for prisoners. Do you think that after this tribunal report and the recent Supreme Court decision that said it was inconsistent with the Bill of Rights, do you think that we might finally see some change?
I definitely do. In our AGM, the last one we had for 2018, we had Andrew Little talking to us, and that was one of the points we brought up with him. And just a month ago, we had Kelvin Davis speaking to our AGM, and both men said that this was something they were seriously going to look into. And I think with Kelvin Davis, with his roots in the Maori world and his really trying hard to basically work on these problems that we've got of over-representation of Maori people in prison, he will look at that. And I just think we need to keep pushing on that. I think it's a really serious issue and it needs to be addressed.
And where do you think the public is, what the public mood is on this issue?
I think they do. I think we had a straw poll and through social media contacts and just generally asked people to sign a petition, we found that nearly 60% of people in normal society thought that people in jail should be able to vote. And I think that's reflected in the Treaty Waitangi Tribunal decision and also just generally in society. I mean, sure, you might have done something wrong, you are locked up, but you're still a person and you've still got basic human rights. And the democratic right to vote is the basis of our whole society. So, you know, I think it's just a no-brainer from my point of view.
And when the law change came in 2010, I believe, do you think National was, rather than pandering to the public, pandering to their voter base to try and seem a bit tough on crime, if you will?
Oh, I think it fits in with the whole Crusher Collins mentality and, basically it's a really punitive attitude, whereas, okay, you've broken the law, you've got your sentence. As soon as you're sentenced, the focus should be on rehabilitation and getting back in society. If you're in jail I was for 2 years and you weren't allowed to vote, it's just another thing that seems unfair. So when you do come out, you think, well, why should I vote? Because they're the people, you know, who are controlling this whole system, and you just feel disenfranchised, but you also feel like you don't want to be franchised. And I think that's a key issue that's overlooked.
And are you worried that if the government does bring back the right to vote, they will only do it for some prisoners, so like those who are serving under 2 years? Are you worried that this might happen?
I'm not worried that it might happen, but I think it will be a big mistake if it does happen.
Mm.
And that was the case when I was in jail. That was the case. But just so happened in Invercargill, they weren't that well organised and they allowed everybody to vote. So, yeah.
So you'd like to see all prisoners being given the right to vote?
Yeah, and I think it should be a whole education program. Like, they should be allowed to, members of Parliament or prospective members of Parliament should be given a platform to talk about corrections and about what their plan is to try and basically get more rehabilitation programs in jail. They should be able to go in there, talk to people who they're supposedly representing. Well, I think the possibility of huge change from having this quite minor issue, like it couldn't take much to bring into power, why aren't we doing it? And that would give a whole lot of people a chance to think about where they're going, their whole program, their rehabilitation, and their connection back to society.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
You're listening to 95BFM. This is Apple Pie Bed by Lawrence Arabia. We'll be back with The Wire.
Since you met me, you've been trying to pull me out of this apple pie bed. You've been pulling, you've been winching, you've been hoisting, but my legs are made of lead.
To bring the car around because it's drive island time.
Get amongst it with Johnny and Big Hungry for a very special live drive show with chats, yarns, friends and lovers, Pete from the Surf Report, plus free coffee thanks to Altura Coffee Company and live musical performances from Cream Jean and Carnivorous Plant Society. Hot dog! 95BFM Drive Island, live from Alan Melville Centre, just off High Street. 4 to 7pm this Friday. Totally free and all ages thanks to NZ On Air Music.
OMG, I'm obsessed with this podcast.
Oh, True Crime Histories.
Or Grimm's Missingsville.
Is it Criminal Yarns?
Craig T. Nelson's Murder Tales.
No.
Oh, I got it. Tragedy Vultures. I love Tragedy Vultures.
Nah, it's one of the other ones where they watch bad movies.
Tacky.
Expand your podcast horizons. All of 95BFM's excellent shows and segments are available as podcasts on iTunes, RSS, or whatever podcatcher you're into. Never miss out again. 95BFM Vcasts. Subscribe to your favourite shows now.
Now it's time for the Southern Cross.
Southern Cross is back, and with us in studio today is Pacific Media Watch contributing editor Michael Andrew. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, friend?
Good. You know, good. We were talking about the weather before. It's just tragic.
You can't dress for it.
Can't dress for it at all.
No, it's just a big mystery.
Yeah, a complete mystery.
Certainly is. A lot of mysteries on at the moment.
I see. Are there?
Well, you know.
On Netflix.
Anyway, are there mysteries in the Pacific?
Yeah. Let's start off.
Yeah.
Is the Pacific. Sweet, yeah, go for it.
So let's start off with the Pacific Islands Forum that's being held this week.
Yeah, so that starts tomorrow and it runs for 3 days from the 13th to the 16th. It's been held in Tuvalu this year, which is quite a poignant reminder, because Tuvalu is one of the countries that are worst affected by rising sea levels due to climate change. So I think it was deliberately held there against the backdrop of literally water lapping at the villages. And this year's summit forum will prioritize climate change at the top of the agenda. And this is reportedly against a bit of a push to include China's influence in the Pacific as the front runner on the agenda, but the Pacific Islands leaders were quite adamant in their assertion that climate change needs to be the priority, and it shouldn't be eclipsed by geopolitical issues such as China's growing influence. And that's obviously Australia's mandate. They want to discuss China.
Well, is there, I suppose we're quite involved, and Australia's quite involved in this Pacific Forum.
Yes, yeah.
How much do we get to set the agenda, and how much do the small Pacific nations kind of get to do it?
Well, it should very much be a consensus, because it acts like the Pacific Island Forum is like the Pacific version of the United Nations. So I think it's roughly around 20 countries, maybe 18. I'll have to double check that. But Australia and New Zealand are certainly the biggest. But Fiji has been having a growing influence and over the other countries. And they've basically, Fiji have said in the past, under Vivek Bainimarama, the Prime Minister, that Australia and New Zealand shouldn't really be included in it, because they don't have the Pacific's best interests at heart.
Mm.
Australia obviously is still pushing intensely on a coal-based industry and economy, and that is a total insult for the Pacific Island leaders, who are trying their best to mitigate climate change, and they're very, very much at the vanguard of climate change effects. Their countries are
going underwater.
The ocean. Yeah, so they're kind of like, well, if you're gonna have this domestic coal policy, then it's not really in our interest. You're kind of compromising your own integrity in this whole thing. So climate change will be, it's been set that it will be at the top of the agenda, but interestingly enough, West Papua is also going to be up there as well. And this is unprecedented, because it's never really been this unanimous decision before to include West Papua. It's always been kind of kept in the shadows, and no one really wants to discuss it, except for Vanuatu. Vanuatu has always been the staunch supporter. So at a preliminary meeting of the Pacific Islands Forum, Vanuatu apparently really debated to include West Papua, and no other country voted it down except for, guess who
Indonesia.
No.
No?
Indonesia not in there. Australia.
Australia, oh.
Australia, yeah. So voted it down because Indonesia's a key ally.
Yeah.
So they obviously, all that nasty political business. But so Australia eventually backed down. The other countries said, yep, we're going to factor in West Papua. We're going to hold Indonesia, try and hold Indonesia accountable for their invitation to the United Nations to come visit West Papua, which is an open invitation, but everyone's a bit skeptical if that's going to be followed through. So there's a deadline that they're going to follow up and keep putting pressure to make this happen. But yeah, very, very good signals for that unanimous support for West Papua, which, as I said, is unprecedented, but it's exactly what the situation needs and calls for, a bit of a united front. Mm. So yeah, that will be on in the next few days, and I'm sure the reports will be coming in from us and other media outlets that are covering the Pacific. But yeah, watch the space.
Yeah. So let's move on to the Philippines. There's been another journalist issue there.
Yeah, so this poor dude was shot in a remote region of the Philippines called Ifugao. And it's still, the reports are still coming in on what exactly happened, but allegedly he's been covering environmental issues, another case of a journalist kind of getting involved in environmental issues where indigenous populations are being kind of attacked by forestry and their lands are being attacked and logged and whatnot. So he's been covering this, and it was reported that the military was following him, and there had been some social media, verbal attacks against him. So the suspicion is that the military are involved. But as I said, the reports are still coming in, and it's still yet to be investigated.
Something's fishy.
Definitely fishy, because, yeah, he was on the kind of hit list, as it were. He's in critical condition. So he got shot, like he got really messed up in the neck and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the local police have said they're going to be launching an investigation task group to look into it. But it's just another sign, another one of these attacks on journalists that are growing and growing. And it's just an escalation what's already happening. So yeah, poor dude. I hope he's okay. And yeah. We'll see what comes of the investigation, but definitely something untoward, and it doesn't seem from the reports at this stage like it was an accident or it was civilian shooting or something like that. Definitely a targeted attempt on his life,
which is just so scary, like working as a journalist in those areas and knowing that that is quite a serious reality. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, which is terrifying.
And it sounded like he was doing good work.
Yeah, just
like
really doing your job.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a report that he was also involved in activism, and that might have made him stand out with the authorities, because the more active you are and the more presence you have, of course, the more you're going to piss off the establishment. But yeah, that's that one.
Yeah, still not great. And then a little bit more about Ihu Mātou. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I did a story about the different cultural and community groups that are backing the occupation and also are getting involved in Tikanga Māori. And one, obviously, it's quite a multicultural affair at Ihu Mātou. I mean, there's so much Pacific presence. There's obviously Samoan presence there. There's a Tongan presence. There's Hawaiian presence, because they have their own similar protests. So it's very much a kind of Pacifica indigenous issue that has attached itself to this movement. It represents a lot of what's happening right now, encroachment on indigenous land. But also there's groups that are supporting as well, such as the Asian supporting Tino Rangatira. This is always a mouthful. Where were we? Asian supporting Tino Rangatiratanga. And they have been one of the biggest presence down there. And outside of the protest, they organise treaty workshops, Treaty of Waitangi workshops, where they can teach other Asian migrants about treaty issues and about the colonial injustices that happen towards Māori. So it's a really powerful message that they're sending out there, and they had some great things to say about the experience of coming here as an Asian migrant and having the Māori world fed to you through a Pākehā narrative,
mm-hmm.
and getting this distorted idea about
what it is.
It's a total misrepresentation.
Yeah. Completely.
And there was this great quote that that one of the members had, that she said that when, you know, the Pākehā establishment have control of these relationships, they pit migrants against Māori, and that division often works in their favour to maintain the colonial status quo. Mm. Which I thought was a real powerful message, and I've talked to other migrant friends who say, yeah, we totally get this idea when we come here that, you know, we should be separated, but these people want to form their own relationships, which is fantastic. They want to build their own relationships. They're getting very involved and the cultural aspects of Māori, learning te reo and whatnot. So a really good organisation there.
Yeah, fantastic. That's amazing.
And also, I'll just say, in line with what your interview before, I interviewed this other woman who's a Muslim human rights lawyer, and she's based in Hamilton. And she's getting involved in Māori affairs because she represents asylum seekers. And she said that when they turn up at the border here in New Zealand, they get sent straight to Mount Eden prison, where their first exposure to Māori is through the criminal system because there's a disproportionate number of Māori.
Mm.
So they form this negative perception, asylum seekers, based on their first experience in New Zealand. And then they go, Māori are criminals. But no, it's just because you got put into this place where it's a total misrepresentation.
And you're not taught taught about anything to do with prisons, I'm sure, when you're there either. So you're just sort of seeing it as it looks, which is not the way it really should be represented. It's horrible.
So this woman, she gets these asylum seekers, and she says, no, it's actually not like that. This is just, the system is calibrated to actually be very punitive against New Zealand's indigenous population because of a long-standing colonial effects.
Mm.
And it's not actually like that. And she gets them more involved and the beautiful cultural aspects of tikanga Māori. So she's doing great work, and she's one of the ardent and very present supporters at the Ihu Mātou protest as well.
That's incredible. It's amazing, hearing so many stories from Ihu Mātou about, amazing people doing
It's really very just, cool, I think it's galvanising that support and that awareness about the plight of, I mean, the attack on Indigenous land and the effects of colonialism.
Absolutely.
Hmm.
Well, let's go back to Australia, where you could talk a little bit more about the ABC raid on journalists there, because we've been hearing about that over the last couple of weeks and the outcome of that.
Like, we never have any good news coming about Australia.
I know. It's a
really
shame,
negative.
Right? I've got an agenda. So I'll just touch on this. So one of the senators in Australia, they've got a version of the Official Information Act called the Freedom of Information, where you can request information from the government, and the government released these papers that basically detailed that there was another agency involved in those raids, and they are most likely the Australian Signals Directorate. And that's particularly concerning because their job is to monitor the calls, monitor the communications of, you know, wanted people outside of Australia. But the story that prompted the raids was they're trying to expand that to be Australians being monitored, so internal domestic surveillance. So this is all quite fishy because the story comes out, okay, this is what the Australian Signals Directorate is doing. It's trying to monitor Australians. Then the raids happen, and then they get this document that says that, the Australian Signals Director was most likely involved. So it's all interrelated around that story. And it's just basically trying to crack down on good journalism, as we've discussed before, because Australians should know if they're being monitored. That's in the public interest.
Completely.
There's no excuse for trying to keep that secret.
Has this caused a bit of an uproar?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's just prompted more questions. It's good that the senators got involved because it's not just the media companies who are pushing for answers and are trying to hold the government accountable, but it's actually public figures and politicians that are taking the sides of the journalists, and that's democracy at work. So there's a countermeasure against these undemocratic practices on behalf of the Australian Federal Police. But sure to develop in the coming weeks.
I just can't believe Australia.
Well, it sort of makes you wonder if it's happening there.
Yeah.
You never know.
No.
You never know. Well, I mean, we've had scandals like that before with Nikki Haga and Dirty Politics.
Yeah, that's
but,
true.
You know, New Zealand didn't really care about that, did we? We just,
That's scary stuff. It's really scary stuff.
It is scary.
It is scary.
So, and then finally, we're going on to the Hiroshima sort of remembrance event in Auckland. Can you talk about that?
Yes. This is a different theme altogether.
Yes.
But every year there is a commemoration of the awful loss of life at Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, the bombing of Japan by the Americans. And this is held to basically remember those people, but also to scrutinize the very widely touted excuse that America used for dropping those bombs and killing 200,000 people in, you know, a matter of days, and then a subsequent another 100,000 from nuclear radiation poisoning and all that. So it was held last night at the Alan Melville Center down in the CBD there in Auckland CBD. But it was a very poignant and profound basically gathering with lots of speeches, lots of talks about people that were directly affected or whose ancestors and descendants were directly affected. And it's just a pledge that we can't take the focus from off nuclear development, because New Zealand's always been ardently opposed to that. It's easily overshadowed, especially there are murmurings against the backdrop of climate change that we need a better energy source, and nuclear is starting to become more of a tangible and practical issue for a lot of people who are saying, well, you know, it's very efficient, but it's still incredibly unstable. And what these folks were saying is that we can't really forget our legacy of protesting against this. And also putting a lot of emphasis on the power of protest. There were a lot of links to the protest down at Ihumatao, and talking about the need for youth and New Zealanders to always be challenging the status quo, always be asking questions, and always be trying to hold the government accountable and exercising our right to protest, which is you know, our New Zealand's bedrock of democratic process was this nuclear movement, and then subsequently the anti-apartheid movement. So there was a lot of emphasis on, you know, reinvigorating our right to protest and getting youth involved along with this theme. So it was a very powerful gathering.
I hadn't even thought about that, but that is about nuclear power and climate change and that being a viable option for some countries. Yeah. That's really scary.
It's easy to get seduced by that, by the efficiency argument that, well, we could generate so much
power.
There's
so much power, but it's so dangerous.
We have amazing wind resources. Yeah. Why would we consider that?
But
it's also quite interesting, the whole change in the narrative about, I guess a lot of people would say, I would not, but a lot of people would say that it was necessary that they dropped a nuclear bomb, you know, to bring about the end of the war sooner, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But you don't really see that being challenged that much, but it's quite interesting that...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there was,
it should be.
If I may, there was a fellow there, and I don't know, I haven't done the research myself, but he's just done a PhD, I think he's done a history PhD, but this topic in particular he's looked into, and he's dug up evidence that suggests that the Americans wanted to develop the bomb as so fast before, because Japanese were actually going to surrender anyway, but they wanted to actually test the effectiveness of the bomb.
Oh, that's awful.
Before Japan surrendered. So they brought over nuclear physicists to help develop it as fast as they could, because they had already cracked the code that Japan was going to surrender. That's what he said.
That's what he
don't
said.
Quote me on that.
This
is a theory.
I'm sure, definitely was not clear cut.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I wouldn't put it past.
No.
Regimes.
A lot of people wouldn't be surprised.
Kind of thing off, anyway.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. Read all about Pacific Media Centre updates at asiapacificreport.nz.
That was The Southern Cross.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
This week, I spoke to James Shaw about a number of things. Last week, the Green Party celebrated a number of law changes, such as amendments to the Misuse of Drugs Act and the abortion legislation bill passing its first reading, both of which aim, both pieces of legislation and bills, aim to move the law away from being a criminal issue to becoming a healthcare issue. We also discussed the recent announcement of Eugenie Sage's next move on waste minimisation. I began by asking James to explain what the changes to the Misuse of Drugs Act are.
Well, the main one was that we've written into the law that the police should use their discretion about whether to prosecute someone who they catch using illegal drugs, and if there is a therapeutic outcome that they think would make more sense than essentially locking someone up in prison, then they ought to pursue that option. And that's a really strong signal, saying that actually we think that if you treat it as a health issue, that's going to be better for that person and also for society at large than getting them into the criminal justice system.
Now, how will this work in practice? How will it be ensured that police will be making uniform decisions across the country with their discretion?
Well, the point is that what we're saying is that they have discretion about whether to prosecute or not. I'll give you an example. A friend of mine, a colleague of mine here in Parliament, had a friend who was, when he was younger, was in a car with four people smoking a joint, and the cops opened the door and prosecuted everyone, over one joint. And, that person lost their job and, all sorts of kind of consequences that affected the rest of their lives. Now, you can't say that society was better served as a result of that. And so in an example like that, if the police were able to exercise their discretion, they could have said, well, okay, well, look, what's going on here? Is a criminal case the best outcome for everyone involved? Or, should we be referring these people to mental health and drug addiction services instead? And then what would be the result of that? What would be the better outcome, not just for those people, but for society at large?
Absolutely, I think that's a good idea, but I suppose will there be training to help the police sort of be able to make that discretionary decision, or is it just a personal morality decision? I suppose that's where I'm confused about it.
Yeah, look, I mean, every time the law changes, it does affect training for police. They have to take account of that, as they're going through. It's normal to expect in these cases you will get some variance around the country because, people are different. But the bill change itself doesn't define whether there'll be, specialist training or anything like that. But you would anticipate, just as happens every other time a law changes, that will flow through into the kinds of training and briefings that the police get.
Now, just continuing on with other changes in the law, the abortion law reform bill passed its first reading last week in another effort to change an issue treated as a crime to a health issue. What are your thoughts on the likelihood of this bill becoming legislation?
Well, I think given the size of the vote in favour of the change, it was, I think, 94 votes in favour and 23 against or something like that. Then I would anticipate that, that there's a very high likelihood. It could, the votes in favour could come down. There are a few MPs who said that they would support it at first reading in order for it to go to select committee, but they would reserve judgment about whether to support the bill at later stages. So I guess that's over to them, but it's pretty, over 90 votes in favour of a change is pretty overwhelming.
Do you anticipate that there will be major changes made at select committee to amend the bill, or do you think it will stay mainly the same?
I don't know. I would anticipate it's more likely to remain where it is at the moment. It's not exactly what the Law Commission recommended, and you know, it's possible, I suppose, that the Select Committee would recommend bringing it closer in line with the Law Commission's recommendations. But we'll just have to see how that goes.
Finally, could you also talk through the waste minimisation consultation Eugenie Sage kicked off on Friday?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. this is actually really quite big news for those of us who are interested in waste management. So we've had this act that's been around since 2008. It was actually brought in as a private member's bill by Nandor Tanchos, a former Green member of Parliament. And the original act provides for what they call product stewardship plans, which is essentially, you sort of take a category like plastic bottles or tyres or electronic waste and something like that, and you basically bring in a sort of a mandatory plan to manage the waste, but you do that with the industry itself. You basically can't do it without the industry because it's really their responsibility to sort of work out how to design waste out of their program. But sometimes it's actually easier for the industry if you've got a regulated system that every company has to adhere to. That's how you get scale across the country, and it's also how you make sure that people aren't in a race to the bottom. So we've never actually in New Zealand exercised that power of having product stewardship plans for any category. And so what we've done is we've said, okay, we're actually going to start using the law as it was intended and bring those in. And there's a whole series of things that we're looking at to go straight out of the gate. It includes things like plastic bottles. It includes tyres. It includes e-waste. It also includes batteries, which is sort of part of thinking, getting ahead of the curve for when electric vehicle batteries come to the end of their lives. How do we dispose of those? And so on.
So obviously this is just in the consultation stages at the moment. How are you planning for it to progress?
Well, as happens with everything, people complain about the number of consultations that we do, but we're actually legally obliged to go out and ask people what they think before we change the law. So at this stage we're saying, and this is, you know, I would anticipate most commentary coming in from the industries that are involved, is to say, well, you know, how can we make this work in practice? And that will help us to design the scheme. And then we don't actually need to do anything legislatively because this is already provided for under the existing Waste Minimisation Act 2008. And then Eugenie, as the minister responsible, can just bring those in under regulations.
So you said that it's already been provided for in the Act. Why hasn't it been something that we've been doing already?
Well, if you just think about the timeline, the original Act was brought in 2008. The government changed from a Labor-led government to a National-led government in 2008. And frankly, they just didn't use the law because they weren't terribly interested.
That's a fair call. So wanting to do something about it now.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, we could have done something about our waste streams in the last 10 years, but we had a government that frankly wasn't up for it.
So
now we do.
What sort of industries will this affect directly that people will be able to see this happening?
Well, probably the thing that's, I guess, the highest touch for most people will be things like food packaging. So, you know, if you go to the supermarket and you see... there are already some quite ridiculous things like sweet corn wrapped in plastic.
Cherry tomatoes.
Cherry tomatoes.
My parents are upset about the cherry tomatoes.
Yeah, that's right. And so I think in fact, the industry is already working pretty... the supermarket industry, they're actually already working pretty hard on a plan to dramatically cut, if not eliminate, plastic food packaging by 2025, which, given the scale of... It is actually pretty ambitious, and we're really pleased about that. But I think you'll start to see fairly immediately, you know, the suppliers to those supermarkets looking for alternatives. You know, so I think that'll be pretty obvious.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire. Are you a dick?
Nah.
Do you like yummy food?
Oh, yeah.
Well, then what's for dinner tonight?
Well, I was thinking...
Wrong. What you need is a Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit. Everything you need to make Lucky Tacos at home in just 10 minutes. Tasty, spicy, fresh, Lucky Tacos make you feel good. And with free delivery in Auckland, why not make it a ritual? Pick up a Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit at your local Faro Fresh or get free delivery direct from the HQ at theluckytaco.co.nz.
A group of emperor penguins huddled close, moving together in synchronized waves. This is Universal Harmony.
Radiating togetherness with positive energy.
This is Universal Harmony.
As wholesome as fresh sliced sourdough and as empowering as winning a prize at school assembly.
This is Universal Harmony.
Tuesday nights from 10 till midnight are reserved for Universal Harmony with Dr. Snickers, only on 95 BFM.
Putting the bubble back in your moe. That's Universal Harmony.
New Zealand is one of very few countries that allows advertising of prescription medicine to consumers, the other main one being the United States. Doctors' groups have been pushing for years for the government to enact changes to the law to ban the practice. I spoke with Richard Medlicott, Medical Director of the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners, about why there is a need for the ban, first asking what the rules around drug advertising were in New Zealand.
Well, essentially there are no rules, so it's open slather. It wasn't a case of putting rules in place. It was more a case of people didn't even think about it all those years ago. So we don't have any rules saying you can't.
We're one of very few countries that still allows it, aren't we?
Yes, two. So there's us in the United States, and generally speaking, in terms of healthcare provision, one doesn't want to be lumped with the United States.
Well, because we do have two very different healthcare systems. How does it work, sort of, with us having a pretty public healthcare system, but private companies are able to advertise their drugs?
It's a case of influencing patients and influence the consumer. That's what all advertising intends to do. So that if you have a condition, let's say asthma, and you've seen an ad on TV for a particular asthma medication, you might come in with a preconceived idea that this is going to be better for you than another treatment that your doctor might talk about with you. In the end, treatment decisions are between the doctor and the patient, but you can be pretty sure that the advertising is not going to be a full discussion of pros and cons and also costs. I mean, very often, with a largely publicly funded health service, very often there are equally effective treatments for lower cost, which is something we need to keep in mind.
And are there any kind of checks on the medicine that is getting advertised? It's quite a rigorous process before you can then get your medicine on TV.
Yeah, so look, there's a couple of issues there. If a medicine is being able to be prescribed, then it would have passed through the MedSafe safety and program. So, you know, it is an approved medication. It's not snake oil as such. But direct to consumer advertising, there's supposed to be some ground rules which are monitored by the industry, and I'm not too sure of exactly what those rules say, to tell you the truth. However, I do know that in the United States, which has a similar kind of industry regulation process, it's been a bit of a failure, really. And the bottom line is that it's very hard to assess every claim made in advertising to approve or not approve an ad. We just don't have the capacity to do all of that, and it's probably best just to ban it.
And yeah, so your position is that it should be banned. What are the main reasons for this?
Well, so it's It's interfering with the really important decision that, that patients make with their doctors about prescribing. It's been shown to cause some harm. I mean, if you think of, say, two drugs that were advertised reasonably widely in New Zealand a number of years ago, one being Vioxx, another one being Reductyl, actually both of those drugs were shown to cause excess deaths and were taken off the market. It's interesting that they were two of a few drugs which were actively promoted. So that's risk to the individual, risk to the doctor-patient relationship and decision-making, and there's also risk to our budget in terms of there are often less expensive alternatives that which are equally effective.
How did GPs deal with someone coming to them and saying, I've seen this on TV, I'd like to try it? Do they often just kind of say yes, okay, or do they offer alternatives?
I'm not sure we've got a lot of data on that. I suppose that the fact that it occurs means the drug companies, the pharmaceutical industry, believes that it works, so it may be influencing that decision making. And there are some studies to show that it does influence that decision. More often than not, it will be, hopefully anyway, a discussion between the doctor and the patient about, well, what options do you have? And it might not be medications at all. It may be more lifestyle interventions and so on.
Do GPs as a whole, are they pretty against advertising?
Yeah, so most GPs, including most of the general population, think it's a bad idea. Pretty clear on that.
And are there any law changes coming up that might affect this?
Yeah, so this is part of the therapeutics bill, which is being discussed. So that, and hence it's kind of risen to a bit of prominence at the moment. So we're hoping that this large bill, of which direct-to-consumer advertising is a small part, will make the correct decisions around DTCA.
And why do you think it's taken so long for this to kind of be looked at from a legislative point of view?
Yes. So it's risen before, I think, the last time, 2003. I may be wrong, maybe 2006. It was a different government. There was coalition deals to be made, and it just didn't get through back then. So I suspect that it's to do with change in government. I suspect, or I'm not sure what the timeline had been for the therapeutics bill in terms of how long that's been in the mix. I guess there's a legislative cue that occurs.
And you've spoken briefly about how the public is in favour of banning it. Why do you think this is?
Look, I think the public is pretty smart quite often. I think they can see that your choice of your detergent for your clothes is different to the pills you might take for a health condition, that there's a fundamental difference between a product for general consumer use versus a medicine which is affecting your health and physiology and which has got some benefits and got some potential side effects. So I think it's more personal to people, and I think they'd rather leave it to a discussion between them and their doctor rather than being influenced by the pharmaceutical industry via TV or magazines or the billboard on the bus shelter.
And quite often, I'll turn on the TV and I'll see an advertisement for an asthma inhaler or something along those lines. But do companies advertise drugs for more serious conditions?
Not that we've seen in New Zealand that I'm aware of, although one must be aware that asthma does kill New Zealand, so that can be pretty serious. But one thing you're seeing in the United States is advertising for some of the very specialised, high-cost cancer agents, of which there's been a lot of media interest in New Zealand. Now, these are difficult decisions about funding and benefit and so on, but they're certainly trying to influence that through very emotionally heart-wrenching ads in the States. So, yeah, we haven't seen it happen here yet, but watch this space.
And just finally, does advertising prescription drugs have any effect on Pharmac and the drugs they buy?
No, I don't think so. I suppose you'd have to ask Pharmac that. It may be that they're companies are trying to influence by getting a certain number of people on these medications and therefore saying to Pharmac, oh, there's a community need out there for funding. But Pharmac's pretty mature. I don't think they're going to get too suckered in by that.
That was The Wire.
That was the Monday Wire for another week. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us for the show today, and thank you very much, Lachlan, for being back and being a good producer. Oh, sorry, I turned on the wrong mic. There you go.
You're welcome, Jemima. You are most welcome. Yep. And thank you to everyone who texted and engaged on Twitter. We've had quite a bit of Twitter engagement today.
Love some Twitter engagement.
People seem to be generally of the view that advertising drugs is bad. Prescription drugs, I should say. And I'd agree with them. I think anything America does, you really don't want to be doing same thing.
And interesting that it's sort of only really us and America. Well, it's probably not great to be the only
two. Yeah, and I don't know, and some of it, I don't know, if I were a GP, I'd get pretty fed up with people being like, I saw this on TV, and you'd be like, well, I actually spent 7 years at medical school. Where's Rahul when you need him?
I know, we could, he would have been perfect to talk to us.
Yeah, next week. But yes, thank you so much to everyone. We really do love engaging with you.
We do, yeah. We're posting a lot at the moment. All the wires are posting heaps on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the moment. So
follow us on Twitter at 95BFM News.
Or on Instagram at 95BFM, or on Facebook at 95BFM News, and also so there are other handles.
And everything's podcasted.
Everything's podcasted on the website. So head over there if you want to have a re-listen to anything or want to listen to anything in the past or in the future. But have a lovely, lovely week, and we will talk to you next time.